From Russia with Love by Ian Fleming, continued. Disc 6.
I don't believe in coincidences any more than you, but one thing is certain. We are not going to share the train with these men. Right? Of course. Then leave it to me, at least for tonight. This is still my country, and I have certain powers in it, and plenty of money. I cannot afford to kill them. The train would be delayed. You and the girl might get involved, but I shall arrange something. Two of them have sleeping berths. The senior man with the mustache and the little pipe is next door to you, here in number 6.
He gestured backwards with his head.
He is travelling on a German passport under the name of Melchior Benz, salesman. The dark one, the Armenian, is in number 12. He too has a German passport. Kurt Goldfarb, construction engineer. They have through tickets to Paris. I have seen their documents. I have a police card. The conductor made no trouble. He has all the tickets and passports in his cabin. The third man, the man with a boil on the back of his neck, turns out also to have boils on his face. A stupid, ugly-looking brute. I have not seen his passport. He is travelling sitting up in the first class, in the next compartment to me. He does not have to surrender his passport until the frontier, but he has surrendered his ticket.
Like a conjurer, Kerim flicked a yellow first-class ticket out of his coat pocket. He slipped it back. He grinned proudly at Bond. How the hell?
Kerim chuckled. Before he settled down for the night, this dumb ox went to the lavatory. I was standing in the corridor, and I suddenly remembered how we used to steal rides on the train when I was a boy. I gave him a minute, then I walked up and rattled the lavatory door. I hung onto the handle very tight. "Ticket collector," I said in a loud voice. "Tickets, please." I said it in French and again in German. There was a mumble from inside. I felt him try to open the door. I hung on tight so that he would think the door had stuck. "Do not derange yourself, monsieur," I said politely. "Push the ticket under the door." There was more fiddling with the door handle, and I could hear heavy breathing. Then there was a pause and a rustle under the door. There was the ticket. I said, "Merci, monsieur," very politely. I picked up the ticket and stepped across the coupling into the next carriage.
Kerim airily waved a hand.
"The stupid oaf will be sleeping peacefully by now. He will think that his ticket will be given back to him at the frontier. He is mistaken. The ticket will be in ashes, and the ashes will be on the four winds."
Kerim gestured towards the darkness outside.
"I will see that the man is put off the train, however much money he has got. He will be told that the circumstances must be investigated, his statements corroborated with the ticket agency. He will be allowed to proceed on a later train."
Bond smiled at the picture of Kerim playing his private school trick. "You're a card, Darko. What about the other two?" Darko Kerim shrugged his massive shoulders.
"Something will occur to me," he said confidently. "The way to catch Russians is to make them look foolish, embarrass them, laugh at them. They can't stand it. We will somehow make these men sweat. Then we will leave it to the MGB to punish them for failing in their duty. Doubtless they will be shot by their own people."
While they were talking, the conductor had come out of number 7. Kerim turned to Bond and put a hand on his shoulder.
"Have no fear, James," he said cheerfully. "We will defeat these people. Go to your girl. We will meet again in the morning. We shall not sleep much tonight, but that cannot be helped. Every day is different. Perhaps we shall sleep tomorrow."
Bond watched the big man move off easily down the swaying corridor. He noticed that, despite the movement of the train, Kerim's shoulders never touched the walls of the corridor. Bond felt a wave of affection for the tough, cheerful, professional spy. Kerim disappeared into the conductor's cabin. Bond turned and knocked softly on the door of number 7. Chapter 22. Out of Turkey. The train howled on through the night. Bond sat and watched the hurrying, moonlit landscape and concentrated on keeping awake. Everything conspired to make him sleep: the hasty metal gallop of the wheels, the hypnotic swoop of the silver telegraph wires, the occasional melancholy, reassuring moan of the steam whistle clearing their way, the drowsy metallic clatter of the couplings at each end of the corridor, the lullaby creak of the woodwork in the little room. Even the deep violet glimmer of the nightlight above the door seemed to say, "I will watch for you.
Nothing can happen while I am burning. Close your eyes and sleep. Sleep.
The girl's head was warm and heavy on his lap. There was so obviously just room for him to slip under the single sheet and fit close up against her, the front of his thighs against the backs of hers, his head in the spread curtain of her hair on the pillow. Bond screwed up his eyes and opened them again. He cautiously lifted his wrist. 4 o'clock. Only one more hour to the Turkish frontier. Perhaps he would be able to sleep during the day. He would give her the gun and wedge the doors again, and she could watch. He looked down at the beautiful sleeping profile. How innocent she looked, this girl from the Russian Secret Service, the lashes fringing the soft swell of the cheek, the lips parted and unaware, the long strand of hair that had strayed untidily across her forehead, and that he wanted to brush back neatly to join the rest, the steady, slow throb of the pulse in the offered neck. He felt a surge of tenderness, and the impulse to gather her up in his arms and strain her tight against him. He wanted her to wake, from a dream, perhaps, so that he could kiss her and tell her that everything was all right, and see her settle happily back to sleep. The girl had insisted on sleeping like this.
"I won't go to sleep unless you hold me," she had said. "I must know you're there all the time. It would be terrible to wake up and not be touching you. Please, James, please, Dushka."
Bond had taken off his coat and tie and had arranged himself in the corner, with his feet up on his suitcase and the Beretta under the pillow within reach of his hand. She had made no comment about the gun. She had taken off all her clothes, except the black ribbon round her throat, and had pretended not to be provocative as she scrambled impudically into bed and wriggled herself into a comfortable position. She had held up her arms to him. Bond had pulled her head back by her hair and had kissed her once, long and cruelly. Then he had told her to go to sleep and had leant back and waited icily for his body to leave him alone. Grumbling sleepily, she had settled herself with one arm flung across his thighs. At first she had held him tightly, but her arm had gradually relaxed, and then she was asleep. Brusquely, Bond closed his mind to the thought of her and focused on the journey ahead. Soon they would be out of Turkey, but would Greece be any easier? No love lost between Greece and England. And Yugoslavia, whose side was Tito on? Probably both. Whatever the orders of the three MGB men, either they already knew Bond and Tatiana were on the train, or they would soon find out. He and the girl couldn't sit for 4 days in this coupé with the blinds drawn. Their presence would be reported back to Istanbul, telephoned from some station, and by the morning the loss of the spectre would have been discovered. Then what? A hasty démarche through the Russian embassy in Athens or Belgrade? Have the girl taken off the train as a thief? Or was that all too simple? And if it was more complicated, if all this was part of some mysterious plot, some tortuous Russian conspiracy, should he dodge it? Should he and the girl leave the train at a wayside station, on the wrong side of the track, and hire a car and somehow get a plane to London? Outside, the luminous dawn had begun to edge the racing trees and rocks with blue. Bond looked at his watch. 5 o'clock. They would soon be at Uzunkopru. What was going on down the train behind him? What had Kerim achieved? Bond sat back, relaxed. After all, there was a simple common-sense answer to his problem. If, between them, they could quickly get rid of the three MGB agents, they would stick to the train and to their original plan. If not, Bond would get the girl and the machine off the train, somewhere in Greece, and take another route home. But if the odds improved, Bond was for going on. He and Kerim were resourceful men. Kerim had an agent in Belgrade who was going to meet the train. There was always the embassy. Bond's mind raced on, adding up the pros, dismissing the cons. Behind his reasoning, Bond calmly admitted to himself that he had an insane desire to play the game out and see what it was all about. He wanted to take these people on and solve the mystery, and, if it was some sort of a plot, defeat it. M had left him in charge. He had the girl and the machine under his hand. Why panic? What was there to panic about? It would be mad to run away and perhaps only escape one trap in order to fall into another one. The train gave a long whistle and began to slacken speed. Now for the first round. If Kerim failed, if the three men stayed on the train. Some goods trucks, led by a straining engine, filed by. The silhouette of sheds showed briefly. With a jolt and a screech of couplings, the Orient Express took the points and swerved away from the through line. Four sets of rails, with grass growing between them, showed outside the window, and the empty length of the down platform. A cock crowed. The express slowed to walking speed, and finally, with a sigh of hydraulic brakes and a noisy whoosh of let-off steam, ground to a stop. The girl stirred in her sleep. Bond softly shifted her head onto the pillow and got up and slipped out of the door. It was a typical Balkan wayside station, a facade of dour buildings in over-pointed stone, a dusty expanse of platform, not raised, but level with the ground so that there was a long step down from the train, some chickens pecking about, and a few drab officials standing idly, unshaven, not even trying to look important. Up towards the cheap half of the train, a chattering horde of peasants, with bundles and wicker baskets, waited for the customs and passport control, so that they could clamber aboard and join the swarm inside. Across the platform from Bond was a closed door with a sign over it which said, Police. Through the dirty window beside the door, Bond thought he caught a glimpse of the head and shoulders of Kerim.
Passport, douane.
A plainclothes man and two policemen in dark green uniform, with pistol holsters at their black belts, entered the corridor. The wagon-lee conductor preceded them, knocking on the doors. At the door of number 12, the conductor made an indignant speech in Turkish, holding out the stack of tickets and passports and fanning through them as if they were a pack of cards. When he had finished, the plainclothes man, beckoning forward the two policemen, knocked smartly on the door, and when it was opened, stepped inside. The two policemen stood guard behind him. Bond edged down the corridor. He could hear a jumble of bad German. One voice was cold, the other was frightened and hot. The passport and ticket of Herr Kurt Goldfarb were missing. Had Herr Goldfarb removed them from the conductor's cabin? Certainly not. Had Herr Goldfarb, in truth, ever surrendered his papers to the conductor? Naturally. Then the matter was unfortunate. An inquiry would have to be held. No doubt the German legation in Istanbul would put the matter right. Bond smiled at this suggestion. Meanwhile, it was regretted that Herr Goldfarb could not continue his journey. No doubt he would be able to proceed tomorrow. Herr Goldfarb would get dressed. His luggage would be transported to the waiting room. The MGB man who erupted into the corridor was the dark Caucasian-type man, the junior of the visitors. His sallow face was grey with fear. His hair was awry, and he was dressed only in the bottom half of his pyjamas. But there was nothing comical about his desperate flurry down the corridor. He brushed past Bond. At the door of number 6 he paused and pulled himself together. He knocked with tense control. The door opened on the chain, and Bond glimpsed a thick nose and part of a moustache. The chain was slipped, and Goldfarb went in. There was silence, during which the plainclothes man dealt with the papers of two elderly Frenchwomen in numbers 9 and 10, and then with Bond's. The officer barely glanced at Bond's passport. He snapped it shut and handed it to the conductor.
"You are travelling with Kerim Bey?"
he asked in French. His eyes were remote.
"Yes. Merci, monsieur. Bon voyage."
The man saluted. He turned and rapped sharply on the door of number 6. The door opened, and he went in. 5 minutes later, the door was flung back. The plainclothes man, now erect with authority, beckoned forward the policemen. He spoke to them harshly in Turkish. He turned back to the coupé.
"Consider yourself under arrest, mein Herr. Attempted bribery of officials is a grave crime in Turkey."
There was an angry clamour in Goldfarb's bad German. It was cut short by one hard sentence in Russian. A different Goldfarb. A Goldfarb with madman's eyes emerged, and walked blindly down the corridor and went into number 12. A policeman stood outside the door and waited.
"And your papers, mein Herr. Please step forward. I must verify this photograph."
The plainclothes man held the green-backed German passport up to the light.
"Forward, please."
Reluctantly, his heavy face pale with anger, the MGB man, who called himself Benz, stepped out into the corridor in a brilliant blue silk dressing gown. The hard brown eyes looked straight into Bond's, ignoring him. The plainclothes man slapped the passport shut and handed it to the conductor.
"Your papers are in order, mein Herr. And now, if you please, the baggage."
He went in, followed by the second policeman. The MGB man turned his blue back on Bond and watched the search. Bond noticed the bulge under the left arm of the dressing gown, and the ridge of a belt round the waist. He wondered if he should tip off the plain-clothes man. He decided it would be better to keep quiet. He might be hauled in as a witness. The search was over. The plain-clothes man saluted coldly and moved on down the corridor. The MGB man went back into number 6 and slammed the door behind him. Pity, thought Bond. One had got away. Bond turned back to the window. A bulky man, wearing a grey Homburg and with an angry boil on the back of his neck, was being escorted through the door marked Police. Down the corridor a door slammed. Goldfarb, escorted by the policeman, stepped down off the train. With bent head, he walked through the dusty platform and disappeared through the same door. The engine whistled. A new kind of whistle, the brave, shrill blast of a Greek engine driver. The door of the Wagon-Lee carriage clanged shut. The plain-clothes man and the second policeman appeared walking over to the station. The guard at the back of the train looked at his watch and held out his flag. There was a jerk, and a diminishing crescendo of explosive puffs from the engine, and the front section of the Orient Express began to move. The section that would be taking the northern route, through the Iron Curtain, through Dragoman on the Bulgarian frontier only 50 miles away, was left beside the dusty platform waiting. Bond pulled down the window and took a last look back at the Turkish frontier, where two men would be sitting in a bare room under what amounted to sentence of death. Two birds down, he thought. 2 out of 3. The odds looked more respectable. He watched the dead, dusty platform with its chickens and the small black figure of the guard until the long train took the points and jerked harshly onto the single main line. He looked away across the ugly, parched countryside towards the golden Guinea sun climbing out of the Turkish plain. It was going to be a beautiful day. Bond drew his head in out of the cool, sweet morning air. He pulled up the window with a bang. He had made up his mind. He would stay on the train and see the thing through. Chapter 23. Out of Greece. Hot coffee from the meagre little buffet at Pythian. There would be no restaurant car until midday. A painless visit from the Greek customs and passport control, and then the berths were folded away as the train hurried south towards the Gulf of Enes at the head of the Aegean. Outside there was extra light and colour. The air was drier. The men at the little stations and in the fields were handsome. Sunflowers, maize, vines, and racks of tobacco were ripening in the sun. It was, as Darko had said, another day. Bond washed and shaved under the amused eyes of Tatiana. She approved of the fact that he put no oil on his hair.
"It is a dirty habit," she said. "I was told that many Europeans have it. We would not think of doing it in Russia, yet dirty is the pillows. But it is odd that you in the West do not use perfume. All our men do."
"We wash," said Bond dryly. In the heat of her protests there came a knock on the door. It was Kerim. Bond let him in. Kerim bowed towards the girl.
"What a charming domestic scene," he commented cheerfully, lowering his bulk into the corner near the door. "I have rarely seen a handsomer pair of spies."
Tatiana glowered at him.
"I am not accustomed to Western jokes," she said coldly.
Karim's laugh was disarming.
"You'll learn, my dear. In England they are great people for jokes. There it is considered proper to make a joke of everything. I also have learned to make jokes. They grease the wheels. I have been laughing a lot this morning. These poor fellows at Uzunkopru. I wish I could be there when the police telephoned the German consulate in Istanbul. That is the worst of forged passports. They are not difficult to make, but it is almost impossible to forge also their birth certificate, the files of the country which is supposed to have issued them. I fear the careers of your two comrades have come to a sad end, Mrs. Somerset."
"How did you do it?" Bond knotted his tie.
"Money and influence. $500 to the conductor. Some big talk to the police. It was lucky our friend tried a bribe. A pity that crafty Ben's next door," he gestured at the wall, "didn't get involved. I couldn't do the passport trick twice. We will have to get him some other way. The man with the boils was easy. He knew no German, and travelling without a ticket is a serious matter. Ah, well, the day has started favourably. "We have won the first round, but our friend next door will now be very careful. He knows what he has to reckon with. Perhaps that is for the best. It would have been a nuisance having to keep you both under cover all day. Now we can move about, even have lunch together, as long as you bring the family jewels with you. We must watch to see if he makes a telephone call at one of the stations. But I doubt if he could tackle the Greek telephone exchange. He will probably wait until we are in Yugoslavia. But there I have my machine. We can get reinforcements if we need them. It should be a most interesting journey. There is always excitement on the Orient Express."
Kerim got to his feet. He opened the door.
"And romance."
He smiled across the compartment.
"I will call for you at lunchtime. Greek food is worse than Turkish, but even my stomach is in the service of the Queen."
Bond got up and locked the door. Tatiana snapped.
"Your friend is not Kulturny. It is disloyal to refer to your queen in that manner."
Bond sat down beside her. "Tanya," he said patiently, "that is a wonderful man. He is also a good friend. As far as I am concerned, he can say anything he likes. He is jealous of me. He would like to have a girl like you. So he teases you. It is a form of flirting. You should take it as a compliment."
"You think so?"
She turned her large blue eyes on his.
"But what he said about his stomach and the head of your state, that was being rude to your queen. It would be considered very bad manners to say such a thing in Russia."
They were still arguing when the train ground to a halt in the sun-baked, fly-swarming station of Alexandropolis. Bond opened the door into the corridor, and the sun poured in across a pale, mirrored sea that married, almost without horizon, into a sky the colour of the Greek flag. They had lunch, with the heavy bag under the table between Bond's feet. Kerim quickly made friends with the girl. The MGB man called Benz avoided the restaurant car. They saw him on the platform buying sandwiches and beer from a buffet on wheels. Kerim suggested they ask him to make a four at bridge. Bond suddenly felt very tired, and his tiredness made him feel that they were turning this dangerous journey into a picnic. Tatiana noticed his silence. She got up and said that she must rest. As they went out of the wagon restaurant, they heard Kerim calling gaily for brandy and cigars. Back in the compartment, Tatiana said firmly,
"Now it is you who will sleep."
She drew down the blind and shut out the hard afternoon light and the endless baked fields of maize and tobacco and wilting sunflowers. The compartment became a dark green underground cavern. Bond wedged the doors and gave her his gun and stretched out with his head in her lap and was immediately asleep. The long train snaked along the north of Greece below the foothills of the Rhodope Mountains. Xanthi came, and Drama, and Serai, and then they were in the Macedonian highlands, and the line swerved due south towards Salonika. It was dusk when Bond awoke in the soft cradle of her lap. At once, as if she had been waiting for the moment, Tatiana took his face between her hands and looked down into his eyes and said urgently,
"Dushka, how long shall we have this for?"
"For long." Bond's thoughts were still luxurious with sleep.
"But for how long?"
Bond gazed up into the beautiful, worried eyes. He cleared the sleep out of his mind. It was impossible to see beyond the next 3 days on the train, beyond their arrival in London. One had to face the fact that this girl was an enemy agent. His feelings would be of no interest to the interrogators from his service and from the ministries. Other intelligence services would also want to know what this girl had to tell them about the machine she had worked for. Probably at Dover she would be taken away to the cage, that well-centred private house near Guildford, where she would be put in a comfortable but oh-so-well-wired room. And the efficient men in plain clothes would come one by one and sit and talk with her, and the recorder would spin in the room below, and the records would be transcribed and sifted for their grains of new fact, and, of course, for the contradictions they would trap her into. Perhaps they would introduce a stool-pigeon, a nice Russian girl who would commiserate with Tatiana over her treatment and suggest ways of escape, of turning double, of getting harmless information back to her parents. This might go on for weeks or months. Meanwhile, Bond would be tactfully kept away from her, unless the interrogators thought he could extract further secrets by using their feelings for each other. Then what? The changed name, the offer of a new life in Canada, the £1,000 a year she would be given from the secret funds? And where would he be when she came out of it all? Perhaps the other side of the world? Or if he was still in London, how much of her feeling for him would have survived the grinding of the interrogation machine? How much would she hate or despise the English after going through all this? And, for the matter of that, how much would have survived of his own hot flame?
"Dushka," repeated Tatyana impatiently, "how long?"
"As long as possible. It will depend on us. Many people will interfere. We shall be separated. It will not always be like this in a little room. In a few days we shall have to step out into the world. It will not be easy. It would be foolish to tell you anything else." Tatyana's face cleared. She smiled down at him.
"You are right. I will not ask any more foolish questions. But we must waste no more of these days."
She shifted his head and got up, and lay down beside him. An hour later, when Bond was standing in the corridor, Darko Kerim was suddenly beside him. He examined Bond's face. He said slyly,
"You should not sleep so long. You have been missing the historic landscape of northern Greece, and it is time for the premiere service."
"All you think about is food," said Bond. He gestured back with his head. "What about our friend?"
"He has not stirred. The conductor has been watching for me. That man will end up the richest conductor in the Wagenlee Company. $500 for Goldfarb's papers, and now $100 a day retainer until the end of the journey."
Kerim chuckled.
"I have told him he may even get a medal for his services to Turkey. He believes we are after a smuggling gang. They're always using this train for running Turkish opium to Paris. He is not surprised, only pleased that he is being paid so well. And now, have you found out anything more from this Russian princess you have in there? I still feel disquiet. Everything is too peaceful. Those two men we left behind may have been quite innocently bound for Berlin, as the girl says. This Benz may be keeping to his room because he is frightened of us. All is going well with our journey. And yet...
Kerim shook his head.
"These Russians are great chess players. When they wish to execute a plot, they execute it brilliantly. The game is planned minutely. The gambits of the enemy are provided for. They are foreseen and countered. At the back of my mind..."
Kerim's face in the window was gloomy.
"I have a feeling that you and I and this girl are pawns on a very big board, that we are being allowed our moves because they do not interfere with the Russian game."
"But what is the object of the plot?" Bond looked out into the darkness. He spoke to his reflection in the window. "What can they want to achieve? We always get back to that. Of course, we have all smelt a conspiracy of some sort, and the girl may not even know that she's involved in it. I know she's hiding something, but I think it's only some small secret she thinks is unimportant. She says she'll tell me everything when we get to London." "Everything? What does she mean?" "She only says that I must have faith, that there is no danger." "You must admit, Darko," Bond looked up for confirmation into the slow, crafty eyes, "that she's lived up to her story." There was no enthusiasm in Kerim's eyes. He said nothing. Bond shrugged. "I admit I've fallen for her. But I'm not a fool, Darko. I've been watching for any clue, anything that would help. You know one can tell a lot when certain barriers are down. Well, they are down, and I know she's telling the truth. At any rate, 90% of it. And I know she thinks the rest doesn't matter. If she's cheating, she's also being cheated herself. On your chess analogy, that is possible. But you still get back to the question of what it's all in aid of." Bond's voice hardened. "And if you want to know, all I ask is to go on with the game until we find out." Kerim smiled at the obstinate look on Bond's face. He laughed abruptly.
"If it was me, my friend, I would slip off the train at Salonika, with the machine, and, if you like, with the girl also, though that is not so important. I would take a hired car to Athens and get on the next plane for London. But I was not brought up to be a sport."
Kerim put irony into the words.
"This is not a game. To me, it is business. For you it is different. You are a gambler. M. also is a gambler. He obviously is, or he would not have given you a free hand. He also wants to know the answer to this riddle. So be it. But I like to play safe, to make certain, to leave as little as possible to chance. You think the odds look right, that they are in your favor?
Darko Kerim turned and faced Bond. His voice became insistent.
Listen, my friend.
He put a huge hand on Bond's shoulder.
This is a billiard table, an easy, flat, green billiard table, and you have hit your white ball, and it is traveling easily and quietly towards the red. The pocket is alongside. Fatally, inevitably, you are going to hit the red, and the red is going into that pocket. It is the law of the billiard table, the law of the billiard room. But outside the orbit of these things, a jet pilot has fainted, and his plane is diving straight at that billiard room, or a gas main is about to explode, or lightning is about to strike, and the building collapses on top of you and on top of the billiard table. Then what has happened to that white ball that could not miss the red ball, and to the red ball that could not miss the pocket? The white ball could not miss according to the laws of the billiard table. But the laws of the billiard table are not the only laws, and the laws governing the progress of this train and of you to your destination are also not the only laws in this particular game.
Kerim paused. He dismissed his harangue with a shrug of the shoulders.
You already know these things, my friend, he said apologetically, and I have made myself thirsty talking platitudes. Hurry the girl up and we will go and eat. But watch for surprises, I beg of you.
He made a cross with his finger over the center of his coat.
I do not cross my heart, that is being too serious, but I cross my stomach, which is an important oath for me. There are surprises on the way for both of us. The gypsy said to watch out. Now I say the same. We can play the game on the billiard table, but we must both be on guard against the world outside the billiard room. My nose, he tapped it, tells me so.
Karim's stomach made an indignant noise, like a forgotten telephone receiver with an angry caller on the other end.
There, he said solicitously, what did I say? We must go and eat.
They finished their dinner as the train pulled into the hideous modern junction of Thessaloniki. With Bond carrying the heavy little bag, they went back down the train and parted for the night.
We shall soon be disturbed again, warned Kerim. There is the frontier at 1 o'clock. The Greeks will be no trouble, but those Yugoslavs like waking up anyone who is travelling soft. If they annoy you, send for me. Even in their country there are some names I can mention. I am in the second compartment in the next carriage. I have it to myself. Tomorrow I will move into our friend Goldfarb's bed in number 12. For the time being, the first class is an adequate stable.
Bond dozed wakefully as the train laboured up the moonlit valley of the Vardar towards the instep of Yugoslavia. Tatiana again slept with her head in his lap. He thought of what Darko had said. He wondered if he could not send the big man back to Istanbul when they had got safely through Belgrade. It was not fair to drag him across Europe on an adventure that was outside his territory and with which he had little sympathy. Darko obviously suspected that Bond had become infatuated with the girl, and wasn't seeing the operation straight any more. Well, there was a grain of truth in that. It would certainly be safer to get off the train and take another route home. But, Bond admitted to himself, he couldn't bear the idea of running away from this plot, if it was a plot. If it wasn't, he equally couldn't bear the idea of sacrificing the 3 more days with Tatiana. And M had left the decision to him. As Darko had said, M also was curious to see the game through. Perversely, M, too, wanted to see what this whole rigmarole was about. Bond dismissed the problem. The journey was going well. Once again, why panic? 10 minutes after they had arrived at the Greek frontier station of Idomeni, there was a hasty knocking on the door. It woke the girl. Bond slipped from under her head. He put his ear to the door. Yes?
Le conducteur, monsieur. There has been an accident. Your friend, Kerim Bey.
Wait, said Bond fiercely. He fitted the Beretta into its holster and put on his coat. He tore open the door. What is it? The conductor's face was yellow under the corridor light.
Come!
He ran down the corridor towards the first class. Officials were clustered round the open door of the second compartment. They were standing, staring. The conductor made a path for Bond. Bond reached the door and looked in. The hair stirred softly on his head. Along the right-hand seat were two bodies. They were frozen in a ghastly death struggle that might have been posed for a film. Underneath was Kerim, his knees up in a last effort to rise. The taped hilt of a dagger protruded from his neck near the jugular vein. His head was thrust back, and the empty, bloodshot eyes stared up at the night. The mouth was contorted into a snarl. A thin trickle of blood ran down the chin. Half on top of him sprawled the heavy body of the MGB man called Benz, locked there by Kerim's left arm round his neck. Bond could see a corner of the Stalin mustache and the side of a blackened face. Kerim's right arm lay across the man's back, almost casually. The hand ended in a closed fist and the knob of a knife hilt, and there was a wide stain on the coat under the hand. Bond listened to his imagination. It was like watching a film. The sleeping Darko. The man slipping quietly through the door. The two steps forward, and the swift stroke at the jugular, then the last violent spasm of the dying man as he flung up an arm and clutched his murderer to him and plunged the knife down towards the fifth rib. This wonderful man, who had carried the sun with him, now he was extinguished, totally dead. Bond turned brusquely and walked out of sight of the man who had died for him. He began, carefully, non-committally, to answer questions. Chapter 24. Out of Danger. The Orient Express steamed slowly into Belgrade at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, half an hour late. There would be an 8 hours' delay while the other section of the train came in through the Iron Curtain from Bulgaria. Bond looked out at the crowds and waited for the knock on the door that would be Kerim's man. Tatiana sat huddled in her sable coat beside the door, watching Bond, wondering if he would come back to her. She had seen it all from the window, the long wicker baskets being brought out to the train, the flash of the police photographer's bulbs, the gesticulating chef de train trying to hurry up the formalities, and the tall figure of James Bond, straight and hard and cold as a butcher's knife, coming and going. Bond had come back and had sat looking at her. He had asked sharp, brutal questions. She had fought desperately back, sticking coldly to her story, knowing that now, if she told him everything, told him, for instance, that Smersh was involved, she would certainly lose him forever. Now she sat and was afraid. Afraid of the web in which she was caught. Afraid of what might have been behind the lies she had been told in Moscow. Above all, afraid that she might lose this man, who had suddenly become the light in her life. There was a knock on the door. Bond got up and opened it. A tough, cheerful india-rubbery man with Kerim's blue eyes and a mop of tangled fair hair above a brown face exploded into the compartment. "Stefan Trempo at your service." The big smile embraced them both. "They call me Tempo. Where is the chef?" "Sit down," said Bond. He thought to himself, "I know it. This is another of Darko's sons." The man looked sharply at them both. He sat down carefully between them. His face was extinguished. Now the bright eyes stared at Bond with a terrible intensity in which there was fear and suspicion. His right hand slipped casually into the pocket of his coat. When Bond had finished, the man stood up. He didn't ask any questions. He said, "Thank you, sir. Will you come, please? We will go to my apartment. There is much to be done." He walked into the corridor and stood with his back to them, looking out across the rails. When the girl came out, he walked down the corridor without looking back. Bond followed the girl, carrying the heavy bag and his little attaché case. They walked down the platform and into the station square. It had started to drizzle. The scene, with its sprinkling of battered taxis and vista of dull modern buildings, was depressing. The man opened the rear door of a shabby Morris Oxford saloon. He got in front and took the wheel. They bumped their way over the cobbles and onto a slippery tarmac boulevard, and drove for a quarter of an hour through wide, empty streets. They saw few pedestrians and not more than a handful of other cars. They stopped halfway down a cobbled side street. Tempo led them through a wide apartment house door and up two flights of stairs that had the smell of the Balkans, the smell of very old sweat and cigarette smoke and cabbage. He unlocked a door and showed them into a two-roomed flat, with nondescript furniture and heavy red plush curtains drawn back to show the blank windows on the other side of the street. On a sideboard stood a tray with several unopened bottles, glasses and plates of fruit and biscuits, the welcome to Darko and to Darko's friends. Tempo waved vaguely towards the drinks.
"Please, sir, make yourself and Madame at home. There is a bathroom. No doubt you would both like to have a bath. If you will excuse me, I must telephone."
The hard facade of the face was about to crumble. The man went quickly into the bedroom and shut the door behind him. There followed two empty hours, during which Bond sat and looked out of the window at the wall opposite. From time to time he got up and paced to and fro, and then sat down again. For the first hour, Tatiana sat and pretended to look through a pile of magazines. Then she abruptly went into the bathroom, and Bond vaguely heard water gushing into the bath. At about 6 o'clock, Tempo came out of the bedroom. He told Bond that he was going out.
"There is food in the kitchen. I will return at 9 and take you to the train. Please, treat my flat as your own."
Without waiting for Bond's reply, he walked out and softly shut the door. Bond heard his foot on the stairs and the click of the front door and the self-starter of the Morris. Bond went into the bedroom and sat on the bed and picked up the telephone and talked in German to the long-distance exchange. Half an hour later there was the quiet voice of M. Bond spoke as a travelling salesman would speak to the managing director of Universal Export. He said that his partner had gone very sick. Were there any fresh instructions?
"Very sick?"
"Yes, sir, very."
"How about the other firm?"
"There were three with us, sir. One of them caught the same thing. The other two didn't feel well on the way out of Turkey. They left us at Uzun Korpru. That's the frontier."
"So the other firm's packed up?"
Bond could see M's face as he sifted the information. He wondered if the fan was slowly revolving in the ceiling, if M had a pipe in his hand, if the chief of staff was listening on the other wire.
"What are your ideas? Would you and your wife like to take another way home?"
"I'd rather you decided, sir. My wife's all right. The sample's in good condition. I don't see why it should deteriorate. I'm still keen to finish the trip. Otherwise it'll remain virgin territory. We shan't know what the possibilities are."
"Would you like one of our other salesmen to give you a hand?"
"It shouldn't be necessary, sir. Just as you feel."
"I'll think about it. So you really want to see this sales campaign through?"
Bond could see M's eyes glittering with the same perverse curiosity, the same rage to know, as he himself felt. "Yes, sir. Now that I'm halfway, it seems a pity not to cover the whole route."
"All right, then. I'll think about giving you another salesman to lend a hand."
There was a pause on the end of the line.
"Nothing else on your mind?"
"No, sir."
"Goodbye, then."
"Goodbye, sir." Bond put down the receiver. He sat and looked at it. He suddenly wished he had agreed with M's suggestion to give him reinforcements, just in case. He got up from the bed. At least they would soon be out of these damn Balkans and down into Italy, then Switzerland, France, among friendly people, away from the furtive lands. And the girl? What about her? Could he blame her for the death of Kerim? Bond went into the next room and stood again by the window, looking out, wondering, going back over everything, every expression and every gesture she had made since he had first heard her voice on that night in the Crystal Palace. No, he knew he couldn't put the blame on her. If she was an agent, she was an unconscious agent. There wasn't a girl of her age in the world who could have played this role, if it was a role she was playing, without betraying herself. And he liked her, and he had faith in his instincts. Besides, with the death of Kerim, had not the plot, whatever it was, played itself out? One day he would find out what the plot had been. For the moment, he was certain, Tatiana was not a conscious part of it. His mind made up, Bond walked over to the bathroom door and knocked. She came out, and he took her in his arms and held her to him and kissed her. She clung to him. They stood and felt the animal warmth come back between them, feeling it push back the cold memory of Kerim's death. Tatiana broke away. She looked up at Bond's face. She reached up and brushed the black comma of hair away from his forehead. His face was alive.
"I am glad you have come back, James," she said.
And then, matter-of-factly,
"And now we must eat and drink and start our lives again."
Later, after Slivovich and smoked ham and peaches, Tempo came and took them to the station and to the waiting express under the hard lights of the arcs. He said good-bye quickly and coldly, and vanished down the platform and back into his dark existence. Punctually at 9, the new engine gave its new kind of noise and took the long train out on its all-night run down the valley of the Sava. Bond went along to the conductor's cabin to give him money and look through the passports of the new passengers. Bond knew most of the signs to look for in forged passports: the blurred writing, the two exact imprints of the rubber stamps, the trace of old gum round the edges of the photograph, the slight transparencies on the pages where the fibres of the paper had been tampered with to alter a letter or a number. But the 5 new passports, 3 American and 2 Swiss, seemed innocent. The Swiss papers, favourites with the Russian forgers, belonged to a husband and wife, both over 70, and Bond finally passed them and went back to the compartment and prepared for another night with Tatiana's head on his lap. Vinkovci came and Brod, and then, against a flaming dawn, the ugly sprawl of Zagreb. The train came to a stop between lines of rusting locomotives, captured from the Germans and still standing forlornly amongst the grass and weeds on the sidings. Bond read the plate on one of them: Berliner Maschinenbau, GmbH, as they slid out through the iron cemetery. Its long, black barrel had been raked with machine-gun bullets. Bond heard the scream of the dive-bomber and saw the upflung arms of the driver. For a moment he thought nostalgically and unreasonably of the excitement and turmoil of the hot war, compared with his own underground skirmishings since the war had turned cold. They hammered into the mountains of Slovenia, where the apple trees and the chalets were almost Austrian. The train laboured its way through Ljubljana. The girl awoke. They had breakfast of fried eggs and hard brown bread and coffee that was mostly chicory. The restaurant car was full of cheerful English and American tourists from the Adriatic coast, and Bond thought with a lift of the heart that by the afternoon they would be over the frontier into Western Europe, and that a third dangerous night was gone. He slept until Susanna. The hard-faced Yugoslav plainclothesmen came on board. Then Yugoslavia was gone, and Poggioreale came, and the first smell of the soft life, with the happy, jabbering Italian officials, and the carefree, upturned faces of the station crowd. The new diesel-electric engine gave a slap-happy whistle, the meadow of brown hands fluttered, and they were loping easily down into Venezia, towards the distant sparkle of Trieste, and the gay blue of the Adriatic. "We've made it," thought Bond. "I really think we've made it." He thrust the memory of the last 3 days away from him. Tatiana saw the tense lines in his face relax. She reached over and took his hand. He moved and sat close beside her. They looked out at the gay villas on the Corniche and at the sailing boats and the people water-skiing. The train clanged across some points and slid quietly into the gleaming station of Trieste. Bond got up and pulled down the window, and they stood side by side, looking out. Suddenly Bond felt happy. He put an arm around the girl's waist and held her hard against him. They gazed down at the holiday crowd. The sun shone through the tall, clean windows of the station in golden shafts. The sparkling scene emphasized the dark and dirt of the countries the train had come from. And Bond watched, with an almost sensuous pleasure, the gaily dressed people pass through the patches of sunshine towards the entrance, and the sunburned people, the ones who had had their holidays, hasten up the platform to get their seats on the train. A shaft of sun lit up the head of one man who seemed typical of this happy, playtime world. The light flashed briefly on golden hair under a cap, and on a young golden moustache. There was plenty of time to catch the train. The man walked unhurriedly. It crossed Bond's mind that he was an Englishman. Perhaps it was the familiar shape of the dark green Kangol cap, or the beige, rather well-used Macintosh, that badge of the English tourist, or it may have been the grey flannelled legs, or the scuffed brown shoes. But Bond's eyes were drawn to him, as if it was someone he knew, as the man approached up the platform. The man was carrying a battered Revelation suitcase, and under the other arm a thick book and some newspapers. "He looks like an athlete," thought Bond. "He has the wide shoulders and the healthy, good-looking, bronzed face of a professional tennis player going home after a round of foreign tournaments." The man came nearer. Now he was looking straight at Bond. With recognition? Bond searched his mind. Did he know this man? No. He would have remembered those eyes that stared out so coldly under the pale lashes. They were opaque, almost dead, the eyes of a drowned man. But they had some message for him. What was it? Recognition? Warning? Or just the defensive reaction to Bond's own stare? The man came up with the wagon-lit. His eyes were now gazing levelly up the train. He walked past, the crepe-soled shoes making no sound. Bond watched him reach for the rail and swing himself easily up the steps into the first-class carriage. Suddenly Bond knew what the glance had meant, who the man was. Of course, this man was from the service. After all, M had decided to send along an extra hand. That was the message of those queer eyes. Bond would bet anything that the man would soon be along to make contact. How like M to make absolutely sure? Chapter 25. A Tie with a Windsor Knot. To make the contact easy, Bond went out and stood in the corridor. He ran over the details of the code of the day, the few harmless phrases, changed on the first of each month, that served as a simple recognition signal between English agents. The train gave a jerk and moved slowly out into the sunshine. At the end of the corridor, the communicating door slammed. There was no sound of steps, but suddenly the red and gold face was mirrored in the window.
"Excuse me, could I borrow a match?"
"I use a lighter." Bond produced his battered Ronson and handed it over. "Better still, until they go wrong." Bond looked up into the man's face, expecting a smile at the completion of the childish "who goes there, pass, friend" ritual. The thick lips writhed briefly. There was no light in the very pale blue eyes. The man had taken off his mackintosh. He was wearing an old reddish-brown tweed coat with his flannel trousers, a pale yellow Viella summer shirt, and the dark blue and red zigzagged tie of the Royal Engineers. It was tied with a Windsor knot. Bond mistrusted anyone who tied his tie with a Windsor knot. It showed too much vanity. It was often the mark of a cad. Bond decided to forget his prejudice. A gold signet ring with an indecipherable crest glinted on the little finger of the right hand that gripped the guardrail. The corner of a red bandana handkerchief flopped out of the breast pocket of the man's coat. On his left wrist there was a battered silver wristwatch with an old leather strap. Bond knew the type. A minor public school and then caught up by the war. Field security, perhaps. No idea what to do afterwards, so he stayed with the occupation troops. At first he would have been with the military police. Then, as the senior men drifted home, there came promotion into one of the security services. Moved to Trieste, where he did well enough. Wanted to stay on and avoid the rigours of England. Probably had a girlfriend, or had married an Italian. The Secret Service had needed a man for the small post that Trieste had become after the withdrawal. This man was available. They took him on. He would be doing routine jobs, have some low-grade sources in the Italian and Yugoslav police and their intelligence networks. $1,000 a year. A good life without much being expected from him. Then, out of the blue, this had come along. Must have been a shock getting one of those most immediate signals. He'd probably be a bit shy of Bond. Odd face. The eyes looked rather mad. But so they did in most of these men doing secret work abroad. One had to be a bit mad to take it on. Powerful chap, probably on the stupid side, but useful for this kind of guard work. M had just taken the nearest man and told him to join the train. All this went through Bond's mind as he photographed an impression of the man's clothes and general appearance. Now he said, "Glad to see you. How did it happen?"
"Got a signal, late last night. Personal from M. Shook me, I can tell you, old man."
Curious accent. What was it? A hint of brogue. Cheap brogue. And something else Bond couldn't define. Probably came from living too long abroad and talking foreign languages all the time. And that dreadful old man at the end. Shyness. "Must have," said Bond sympathetically. "What did it say?"
"Just told me to get on the Orient this morning and contact a man and a girl in the through carriage. More or less described what you looked like. Then I was to stick by you and see you both through to Gay Paris. That's all, old man."
Was there defensiveness in the voice? Bond glanced sideways. The pale eyes swiveled to meet his. There was a quick red glare in them. It was as if the safety door of a furnace had swung open. The blaze died. The door to the inside of the man was banged shut. Now the eyes were opaque again, the eyes of an introvert, of a man who rarely looks out into the world but is forever surveying the scene inside him. There's madness there, all right, thought Bond, startled by the sight of it. Shell-shock, perhaps, or schizophrenia. Poor chap, with that magnificent body. One day he would certainly crack. The madness would take control. Bond had better have a word to personnel, check up on his medical. By the way, what was his name? Well, I'm very glad to have you along. Probably not much for you to do. We started off with 3 Redland men on our tail. They've been got rid of, but there may be others on the train, or some more may get on. And I've got to get this girl to London without trouble. If you just hang about. Tonight we'd better stay together and share watches. It's the last night, and I don't want to take any chances. By the way, my name's James Bond, travelling as David Somerset, and that's Caroline Somerset in there. The man fished in his inside pocket and produced a battered note-case which seemed to contain plenty of money. He extracted a visiting card and handed it to Bond. It said, Captain Norman Nash, and in the left-hand bottom corner, Royal Automobile Club. As Bond put the card in his pocket, he slipped his finger across it. It was engraved. Thanks, he said. Well, Nash, come and meet Mrs. Somerset. No reason why we shouldn't travel more or less together. He smiled encouragingly. Again the red glare quickly extinguished. The lips writhed under the young golden moustache. Delighted, old man. Bond turned to the door and knocked softly and spoke his name. The door opened. Bond beckoned Nash in and shut the door behind him. The girl looked surprised. This is Captain Nash, Norman Nash. He's been told to keep an eye on us.
How do you do?
The hand came out hesitantly. The man touched it, briefly. His stare was fixed. He said nothing. The girl gave an embarrassed little laugh.
Won't you sit down?
Thank you.
Nash sat stiffly on the edge of the banquette. He seemed to remember something, something one did when one had nothing to say. He groped in the side pocket of his coat and produced a packet of players.
Will you have a cigarette?
He prized open the top with a fairly clean thumbnail, stripped down the silver paper, and pushed out the cigarettes. The girl took one. Nash's other hand flashed forward a lighter with the obsequious speed of a motor salesman. Nash looked up. Bond was standing, leaning against the door, and wondering how to help this clumsy, embarrassed man. Nash held out the cigarettes and the lighter as if he was offering glass beads to a native chief.
"What about you, old man?"
"Thanks," said Bond. He hated Virginia tobacco, but he was prepared to do anything to help put the man at ease. He took a cigarette and lit it. They certainly had to make do with some queer fish in the service nowadays. How the devil did this man manage to get along in the semi-diplomatic society he would have to frequent in Trieste? Bond said lamely, "You look very fit, Nash. Tennis?
Swimming.
Been long in Trieste?" There came the brief red glare.
"About 3 years."
"Interesting work?"
"Sometimes. You know how it is, old man."
Bond wondered how he could stop Nash calling him old man. He couldn't think of a way. Silence fell. Nash obviously felt it was his turn again. He fished in his pocket and produced a newspaper cutting. It was the front page of the Corriere della Sera. He handed it to Bond.
"Seen this, old man?"
The eyes blazed and died. It was the front page lead. The thick black lettering on the cheap newsprint was still wet. The headline said,
"Terribile esplosione in Istanbul. Ufficio sovietico distrutto. Tutti i presenti uccisi."
Bond couldn't understand the rest. He folded the cutting and handed it back. How much did this man know? Better treat him as a strong-arm man and nothing else.
"Bad show," he said. "Gas main, I suppose."
Bond saw again the obscene belly of the bomb hanging down from the roof of the alcove in the tunnel, the wires that started off down the damp wall on the way back to the plunger in the drawer of Kerim's desk. Who had pressed the plunger yesterday afternoon when Tempo had got through? The head clerk? Or had they drawn lots and then stood round and watched as the hand went down and the deep roar had gone up in the street of books on the hill above? They would all have been there in the cool room, with eyes that glittered with hate. The tears would be reserved for the night. Revenge would have come first. And the rats? How many thousand had been blasted down the tunnel? What time would it have been? About 4 o'clock. Had the daily meeting been on? 3 dead in the room. How many more in the rest of the building? Friends of Tatyana, perhaps. He would have to keep the story from her. Had Darko been watching? From a window in Valhalla? Bond could hear the great laugh of triumph echoing round its walls. At any rate, Kerim had taken plenty with him. Nash was looking at him.
"Yes, I dare say it was a gas main," he said without interest.
A handbell tinkled down the corridor, coming nearer.
"Deuxième service, deuxième service. Prenez vos places, s'il vous plaît."
Bond looked across at Tatyana. Her face was pale. In her eyes there was an appeal to be saved from any more of this clumsy, non-culturni man. Bond said, "What about lunch?" She got up at once. "What about you, Nash?" Captain Nash was already on his feet.
"Had it, thanks, old man, and I'd like to have a look up and down the train. Is the conductor, you know?"
He made a gesture of fingering money. "Oh, yes, he'll cooperate all right," said Bond. He reached up and pulled down the heavy little bag. He opened the door for Nash. "See you later." Captain Nash stepped into the corridor. He said,
"Yes, I expect so, old man."
He turned left and strode off down the corridor, moving easily with the swaying of the train, his hands in his trouser pockets, and the light blazing on the tight golden curls at the back of his head. Bond followed Tatyana up the train. The carriages were crowded with holidaymakers going home. In the third-class corridors, people sat on their bags, chattering and munching at oranges, and at hard-looking rolls with bits of salami sticking out of them. The men carefully examined Tatyana as she squeezed by. The women looked appraisingly at Bond, wondering whether he made love to her well. In the restaurant car, Bond ordered Americanos and a bottle of Chianti Broglio. The wonderful European hors d'oeuvres came. Tatyana began to look more cheerful. "Funny sort of man," Bond watched her pick about among the little dishes. "But I'm glad he's come along. I'll have a chance to get some sleep. I'm going to sleep for a week when we get home."
"I do not like him," the girl said indifferently. "He is not culturni. I do not trust his eyes."
Bond laughed. "Nobody is culturni enough for you."
"Did you know him before?"
"No, but he belongs to my firm."
"What did you say his name is?"
"Nash. Norman Nash." She spelled it out.
"N-A-S-H? Like that?"
"Yes." The girl's eyes were puzzled.
"I suppose you know what that means in Russian. Nash means ours. In our services, a man is Nash when he is one of our men. He is Zvoy when he is one of theirs, when he belong to the enemy. And this man calls himself Nash. That is not pleasant."
Bond laughed. "Really, Tanya, you do think of extraordinary reasons for not liking people. Nash is quite a common English name. He's perfectly harmless. At any rate, he's tough enough for what we want him for." Tatyana made a face. She went on with her lunch. Some tagliatelle verdi came, and the wine, and then a delicious escalope.
"Oh, it is so good," she said. "Since I came out of Russia, I am all stomach."
Her eyes widened.
"You won't let me get too fat, James. You won't let me get so fat that I am no use for making love. You will have to be careful, or I shall just eat all day long and sleep. You will beat me if I eat too much?"
"Certainly I will beat you." Tatyana wrinkled her nose. He felt the soft caress of her ankles. The wide eyes looked at him hard. The lashes came down demurely.
"Please pay," she said. "I feel sleepy."
The train was pulling into Mestre. There was the beginning of the canals. A cargo gondola full of vegetables was moving slowly along a straight sheet of water into the town. "But we shall be coming into Venice in a minute," protested Bond. "Don't you want to see it?"
"It will be just another station, and I can see Venice another day. Now I want you to love me, please, James."
Tatyana leaned forward. She put a hand over his.
"Give me what I want. There is so little time."
Then it was the little room again, and the smell of the sea coming through the half-open window, and the drawn blind fluttering with the wind of the train. Again there were the two piles of clothes on the floor, and the two whispering bodies on the banquette, and the slow, searching hands, and the love knot formed, and as the train jolted over the points into the echoing station of Venice, there came the final, lost, despairing cry. Outside the vacuum of the tiny room, there sounded a confusion of echoing calls and metallic clanging and shuffling footsteps that slowly faded into sleep. Padua came, and Vicenza, and a fabulous sunset over Verona flickered gold and red through the cracks of the blind. Again the little bell came tinkling down the corridor. They woke. Bond dressed and went into the corridor and leant against the guardrail. He looked out at the fading pink light over the Lombardy plain and thought of Tatiana and of the future. Nash's face slid up alongside his in the dark glass. Nash came very close, so that his elbow touched Bond's.
"I think I've spotted one of the Oppo, old man," he said softly.
Bond was not surprised. He had assumed that if it came it would come tonight. Almost indifferently he said, "Who is he?"
"Don't know what his real name is, but he's been through Trieste once or twice. Something to do with Albania. Maybe the resident director there. Now he's on an American passport. Wilbur Frank. Calls himself a banker. In number 9, right next to you. I don't think I could be wrong about him, old man."
Bond glanced at the eyes in the big brown face. Again the furnace door was ajar. The red glare shone out and was extinguished. "Good thing you spotted him. This may be a tough night. You'd better stick by us from now on. We mustn't leave the girl alone."
"That's what I thought, old man."
They had dinner. It was a silent meal. Nash sat beside the girl and kept his eyes on his plate. He held his knife, like a fountain pen, and frequently wiped it on his fork. He was clumsy in his movements. Halfway through the meal he reached for the salt and knocked over Tatiana's glass of Chianti. He apologized profusely. He made a great show of calling for another glass and filling it. Coffee came. Now it was Tatiana who was clumsy. She knocked over her cup. She had gone very pale, and her breath was coming quickly. "Tatiana." Bond half rose to his feet, but it was Captain Nash who jumped up and took charge.
"Ladies come over queer," he said shortly. "Allow me."
He reached down and put an arm round the girl and lifted her to her feet.
"I'll take her back to the compartment. You'd better look after the bag. And there's the bill. I can take care of her till you come." "It's all right," protested Tatiana, with the slack lips of deepening unconsciousness. "Don't worry, James. I lie down."
Her head lolled against Nash's shoulder. Nash put one thick arm round her waist and manoeuvred her quickly and efficiently down the crowded aisle and out of the restaurant car. Bond impatiently snapped his fingers for the waiter. Poor darling, she must be dead beat. Why hadn't he thought of the strain she was going through? He cursed himself for his selfishness. Thank heavens for Nash. Efficient sort of chap, for all his uncouthness. Bond paid the bill. He took up the heavy little bag and walked as quickly as he could down the crowded train. He tapped softly on the door of number 7. Nash opened the door. He came out with his finger on his lips. He closed the door behind him.
"Through a bit of a faint," he said. "She's all right now. The beds were made up. She's gone to sleep in the top one. Been a bit much for the girl, I expect, old man."
Bond nodded briefly. He went into the compartment. A hand hung palely down from under the sable coat. Bond stood on the bottom bunk and gently tucked the hand under the corner of the coat. The hand felt very cold. The girl made no sound. Bond stepped softly down. Better let her sleep. He went into the corridor. Nash looked at him with empty eyes.
"Well, I suppose we'd better settle in for the night. I've got my book."
He held it up.
"War and Peace. Been trying to plough through it for years.
You take the first sleep, old man. You look pretty flaked out yourself.
I'll wake you up when I can't keep my eyes open any longer."
He gestured with his head at the door of number 9.
"Hasn't shown yet. Don't suppose he will if he's up to any monkey tricks."
He paused.
"By the way, you got a gun, old man?"
"Yes. Why, haven't you?"
Nash looked apologetic. "Afraid not. Got a Luger at home, but it's too bulky for this sort of job."
"Ah, well," said Bond reluctantly. "You'd better take mine. Come on in." They went in, and Bond shut the door. He took out the Beretta and handed it over. 8 shots," he said softly. "Semi-automatic. It's on safe." Nash took the gun and weighed it professionally in his hand. He clicked the safe on and off. Bond hated someone else touching his gun. He felt naked without it. He said gruffly, "Bit on the light side, but it'll kill if you put the bullets in the right places." Nash nodded. He sat down near the window at the end of the bottom bunk.
"I'll take this end," he whispered. good field of fire." He put his book down on his lap and settled himself. Bond took off his coat and tie and laid them on the bunk beside him. He leant back against the pillows and propped his feet on the bag with a spectre that stood on the floor beside his attaché case. He picked up his Ambler and found his place and tried to read. After a few pages he found that his concentration was going. He was too tired. He laid the book down on his lap and closed his eyes. Could he afford to sleep? Was there any other precaution they could take? The wedges. Bond felt for them in the pocket of his coat. He slipped off the bunk and knelt and forced them hard under the two doors. Then he settled himself again and switched off the reading light behind his head. The violet eye of the nightlight shone softly down.
"Thanks, old man," said Captain Nash softly.
The train gave a moan and crashed into a tunnel.
Chapter 26. The Killing Bottle. The light nudge at his ankle woke Bond. He didn't move. His senses came to life like an animal's. Nothing had changed. There were the noises of the train, the soft iron stride, pounding out the kilometres, the quiet creak of the woodwork, a tinkle from the cupboard over the washbasin where a toothglass was loose in its holder. What had woken him? The spectral eye of the nightlight cast its deep velvet sheen over the little room. No sound came from the upper bunk. By the window, Captain Nash sat in his place, his book open on his lap, a flicker of moonlight from the edge of the blind showing white on the double page. He was looking fixedly at Bond. Bond registered the intentness of the violet eyes. The black lips parted. There was a glint of teeth.
"Sorry to disturb you, old man. I feel in the mood for a talk."
What was there new in the voice? Bond put his feet softly down to the floor. He sat up straighter. Danger, like a third man, was standing in the room. "Fine," said Bond easily. What had there been in those few words that had set his spine tingling? Was it the note of authority in Nash's voice? The idea came to Bond that Nash might have gone mad. Perhaps it was madness in the room and not danger that Bond could smell. His instincts about this man had been right. It would be a question of somehow getting rid of him at the next station. Where had they got to? When would the frontier come?
This book is continued on Disc 7.